Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you politics without the boring bits, as I always do, Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. You can catch me on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Coming up, help! My mum's running the country. We heard a lot this week about what it's like if your husband's running the country, thanks to Akshata Murthy, who introduced Rishi Sunak for his big speech. But what about if it's your mum? I've been speaking to Carol Thatcher, a really fascinating, funny conversation about the weird family dynamics of basically having Margaret Thatcher as your mum. That's coming up in just a moment. But the big political story of the day, of course, is the Rutherglen and Hamilton West by-election result. Labour securing a swing of more than 20% from the SNP. Here's the result as it came in.
Michael Shanks, Scottish Labour Party, 17,840. And I declare that Michael Shanks is elected to serve in the United Kingdom Parliament as a member for Rutherglen and Hamilton West constituency.
So it's a big, big win, a 20.4 percentage point swing to Labour from the SNP. But what does that mean for Keir Starmer's prospects of becoming Prime Minister? Joining me in the studio is Times Radio senior political correspondent Patrick Maguire.
Good morning, Matt.
And on the line, we've got Professor Sir John Curtis, pollster at the University of Strathclyde. Hi, John.
Good morning to you, Matt.
John, crunch the numbers for us. What do they mean and what do they tell us about a general election next year?
Okay, well, you suggested this now. What difference does it make to Labour's chances or Sir Keir Starmer's chances of becoming Prime Minister? The answer to that question is probably approximately zero, because irrespective of whether Scotland elects SNP or Labour MPs, neither of them is going to be willing to help to sustain a minority Conservative administration. Where, however, it does potentially make a difference is to Labour's chances of getting an overall majority and therefore being able to find government at least a little more comfortable than it otherwise would be the case. This result is, in a sense, in stark contrast with virtually everything we have seen in Scotland since the 2014 independence referendum. You'll remember shortly after that, in the 2015 general election, Labour was down to one seat, what it's still at, and its former domination of representation in Scotland disappeared. Now, in this by-election, we get Labour Party not only getting a 20% swing, a swing that, if it were to occur across Scotland as a whole, and of course it may not necessarily, would see Labour back up to the 40 seats or so that it used to take for granted in Scotland, but also the 58-59% that Labour secured in Rutherglen is almost as high as it got in that constituency back in 2010. So certainly I think we have to conclude that although by-elections often exacerbate the swing against the government, it may well be the case that many a voter was protesting both against the SNP government at Holyrood and the Conservative government at Westminster in a way that perhaps they wouldn't have done to the same degree in a general election. But I think we have now to say that the message of the opinion polls in recent weeks and months that Labour pose a serious challenge to the SNP's current level of representation of Westminster, that is now very, very clearly the case.
And the interesting thing, Patrick, is as a reminder as well that although people say, oh, the Conservatives don't have any place in Scotland. If you look back, you know, and this is in this seat, the Conservatives did much better in like 2017, and that Conservative vote has collapsed. And actually, that sort of union get the SNP out vote, unionist SNP get the SNP out vote, has all gone to Labour. You can sort of see the sort of U-shaped graph, if you like, of what's happened to the Labour support.
Exactly. Indeed, even in 2019, the Conservatives won about 12% of the vote in Rutherglen and Hamilton West. Compare that to last night when they lost their deposit. Now, clearly, Labour would have won without tactical votes from the Conservatives, so large was their majority. But equally, it's hugely significant that Conservative voters in this case, and indeed maybe in other cases in the West and Central Belt of Scotland, where SNP majorities could be overturned by tactical voting, it's hugely significant that Conservative voters have chosen in such numbers either to stay at home or indeed back the Labour candidate.
I know you've been...
Can I make two caveats to that, though?
Yeah, absolutely, John.
I mean, caveat number one is that in a by-election, Conservative voters could vote for the Labour candidate without any fear that in so doing, they might be enabling Labour to get into government. So it's easier for voters to vote tactically in the context of the by-election. The second thing to say is, look, the Conservative Party in Scotland is suffering from Partygate and the Liz Truss fiscal event as much as the party is south of the border. The party is 9 points down in the opinion polls in Scotland. The fact that its vote is down by 11 points in Rutherglen is therefore, to that extent, not a surprise. The Conservative Party in Scotland is in trouble because the Conservative Party across the United Kingdom as a whole is in deep trouble.
John, just take us through the what's happening to the SNP vote, because again, it's, you know, it's astonishing that they've gone from riding so high. I mean, clearly, since then they've had a change of leader, and Humza Yousaf isn't going down as well, and all of the allegations around party funding and the police investigation and so on. Is this a sign that actually the SNP have sort of turned a corner, which is going to be difficult to come back from?
Well, it's not going to be easy to come back from, but that doesn't necessarily mean to say it's impossible. I mean, the opinion polls on average show Labour, the SNP support down about 8 points as compared with 2019. But of course, in this by-election, its vote is down by 16 points. I mean, the reason why we're all slightly shocked and surprised this morning is not because Labour won the by-election. It's the scale of Labour's success is much greater than was expected. So it is very, very clear. As I was saying earlier, Labour now poses a serious chance to the SNP. Now, if you look, track the history of the decline in SNP support during the course of this year, it's pretty clear that the decisive event is not the difficulties about the allegations about the party's finances. Yes, after the arrest, but then subsequent release of Nicola Sturgeon, there was a bit of hit on the SNP, but the party support primarily declined during the leadership contest. And that's a leadership contest that has left the SNP with a leader who is markedly less popular than his predecessor, and which exposed divisions that already had begun to emerge during the gender recognition row, divisions within the party over the economic management of Scotland, over the interests of urban versus rural Scotland, and over the coalition with the Greens in which the SNP is currently occupied. And those divisions have been noticed by voters. The proportion of people who think that the SNP isn't divided has gone up, isn't united, has gone up from around a third in October of last year to over 50% now. And voters, frankly, tend not to vote for divided parties. The difficulty, of course, facing Mr. Yousaf, given the backdrop of the finances, and given the internal arguments still within the party about how it should fight the next general election and how far should it foreground independence, is, does he, as somebody who only won the leadership narrowly, does he have the authority to unite his party? Can he provide his party with the inspiration it needs in order to get a clear path as to how it's going to fight? It's around that that I think there are doubts, and they are doubts that Mr. Yousaf at least needs to try to dispel.
John, we should caveat, of course, that only 37% of the good people in Rutherglen and Hamilton West.
Yeah, but that's not surprisingly low for a by-election, right? Look, I mean, every time a party does badly in a by-election, it's, oh, look at the turnout, it's not terribly high. They can always say that because the turnout is nearly always not terribly high.
Fine. Very good. Patrick, what are Labour people telling you, and what have they done in during this campaign to clearly take what was an expectation they might win and turn it into winning big? Was it deploying Sue Gray on the doorsteps?
Well, Sue Gray was indeed on the doorsteps yesterday. Quite a surreal sight to see a former civil servant, still less Sue Gray, holding a Labour leaflet in one of her first outings as Keir Starmer's chief of staff. Look, the best way to describe how the Labour Party see this, how the top of the Labour Party see this, is in fact with a quote from Donald Dewar, who listeners might remember was the first ever First Minister of Scotland, the father of devolution. In 1978, he won for Labour a by-election against the SNP in Glasgow Garscadden. And he said, after he won, against expectations, that it had changed the whole psychological mood of Scottish politics. There was a sense that the SNP was a sort of unstoppable juggernaut at that point. Jim Callaghan's government was in the doldrums. That is very much how the Labour Party see this. They now see themselves as competitive again. As for how this has happened, this is the culmination of about 2.5 years of work. One of Keir Starmer's little notice but most significant acts in his first year of Labour leader was effectively to sack the leader of the Scottish Labour Party, a Corbynite called Richard Leonard. In the years since, Anna Sarwar, who's become very close indeed to Keir Starmer, has been installed as leader. And last year, he came down to London and said, look, the mood in the country is turning. If you give me the resources to target 10 to 20 seats, you will see returns. Keir Starmer's office were divided on that plan, but it won the support of Keir Starmer and his campaign director, Morgan McSweeney. And you're now seeing a well-resourced Scottish Labour Party, well-organised Scottish Labour Party. Significant, I think, that 65% of these votes were postal votes, which suggests Labour were very organised in getting their votes out. Lots of London activists bussed up and London staff bussed up. So it's a testament to how organised and well-drilled the machine the Labour Party has become.
Just finally to you, John, I mean, this, you know, if replicated, would suggest that Keir Starmer is on course to become Prime Minister, possibly with a decent, workable majority. It also suggests Scottish independence is dead, doesn't it?
Two things don't necessarily go together. Yes, progress in achieving Scottish independence, at least so far as holding referendum is concerned, is not going to go any further. But we should remember that although support for the SNP has fallen this year, support for independence has not. It's still running at 47-48%. It's just that some yes supporters at the moment are willing to vote for the Labour Party.
Thanks very much for that, as Professor John Curtis. Patrick, just more broadly on reading your column today, looking ahead to the Labour Party conference. I mean, no better way to go into the party conference than with a big by-election win. So Keir Starmer will have a spring in his step. But as you point out in your column today, he's got quite a lot of work to do when he gets to Liverpool.
Yes, of course he does. The interesting thing about last week's Tory conference, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as people at the top of the Labour Party are concerned, is that this is a Conservative Party leadership, regardless of the wisdom of its strategy, that has an electoral strategy that you and I could explain in a sentence, whether or not we'd start sniggering at the end of that sentence. Can we really say the same of the Labour Party beyond we are not the Conservative Party, we are not this government, we're the only lever you have to pull to get this government out? Now, look, in first past the post elections, that's all you really need to be. But that doesn't mean that there are people at the top of the Labour Party who are getting a little bit nervous that they haven't yet sharpened their message, sharpened their strategy in response to this new, in their view, quite cynical Conservative way of doing business. And that is the challenge for the Labour Party, to respond to that new Tory approach and set out their own retail offer to the country in Liverpool next week.
John Curtis and Patrick Maguire there. And if that's the sort of content that you like, you can come and see us live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, Friday, October the 13th. We are debating, what election year is it? Is it 1997, a Labour landslide? Is it 1992, the Tories nick it? Is it 1974, where there were two general elections? Join me for the Times Radio Debate with Professor Sir John Curtis, Crunch of the Numbers. We'll have Patrick Maguire, Aisha Hazarika, and Kate McCann. If you want to join us live, just go to cheltenhamfestivals.com/literature, buy your tickets, and we'll see you live next Friday. Right, up next, it's Carol Thatcher telling me what it's like if your mum is running the country.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
You turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
I remember looking at these two, being so relieved that the doctor had managed to get both of them.
We have become a grandmother of a grandson called Michael.
Help! My mum's running the country. Yeah, so this week we've got actually a bit of an insight on what it's like if your husband is running the country. Mick Chartamurty introducing Rishi Sunak at the party conference this week. But what's it like when you're living behind that black, shiny door of number 10? Well, Carol Thatcher knows better than most. Her mum, of course, lived there for over a decade. I've been speaking to her about what life is like when your mum is running the country. So I started off by asking her when she realised that her mum was kind of a big deal.
Well, a big deal, not necessarily, but she got into Parliament as an MP when I was 6 years old. And I remember sort of boasting to my schoolmates, my mum's in the House of Commons, they have green benches. In the House of Lords, they have red benches. All of my friends went, what? And also, one of my school outings was to go up Big Ben. You walk up the steps inside, then you walk around behind the clock face and that sort of thing. So she was an MP. When did it get to the stage when she was really in the public eye? I think when I was a student, a law student, she was Secretary of State for Education. And this was definitely tricky because students on the whole don't like the holder of that job, and she was no exception. So my colleagues at London University were saying, OK, we're going off to demonstrate against your mum. Can you just remind us where her office is and this sort of thing? So I think that was splashdown, Matt, if I may describe it like that. And then, of course, she was leader of the opposition for several years, 75 to 79, let me get it right, and then Prime Minister. So it was a sort of running in period.
And what's that like? Because particularly when you're a student, everyone basically finds their parents a bit embarrassing, you know, in one way or another, you want to rebel against them. Did you ever join those? I mean, the ultimate rebellion would be joining the chants of Thatcher, Milk Snatcher and all of that.
I was a Conservative, but that's finished me. This milk has finished me. Never again will I vote Conservative. Hurting children is absolutely the end.
Did you ever join the protests?
No, I didn't. And I didn't take a lot of student friends home because I didn't feel it was very fair for my mother around the Sunday lunch table in her own home to have to defend her own policies, if you see what I mean. I've always said if you've got a famous parent, Matt, it's not, you are not famous, it's second-hand fame. It's the parent who's famous. And if you've got a parent who's famous in politics, as opposed to sport or telly or showbiz or tycoonery like Elon Musk. It's quite different in politics because everyone has a view. And they are inclined to tell you their view. Because so you're sort of blotting paper for voters' opinions. And I remember my father, I was his biography, and he was in the same boat. He was the husband, you know, Mr. Maggie Thatcher. And I remember him saying, you know, it's not everyone who wants to talk to you who actually makes sense. And that's true, because people say, Carol, I think your mum's doing a lousy job in number 10. Bring back national service. And you have to listen to all of this, Matt. And you can't say, excuse me, take a long walk off a short plank, because whoever's telling you might decide to vote for someone else.
And yet you have no agency over doing anything about it. You just have to absorb it.
Yes.
And then nod politely and walk off. And what was it like growing up in the 50s and into the 60s? With your mum juggling, I mean, actually, even to have a working mum at all was quite unusual. To be a politician, juggling constituency and parliament and a family, how did you do with juggling all of that?
I remember looking at these two, being so relieved that the doctor had managed to get both of them, because there was some doubt whether he could, and thinking, now, this is fantastic. Now, if I'm not careful, I'm never going to make an effort to get back to a sort of intellectual pursuit. I'm just going to be so overcome with this that I'm not going to continue with law or politics or anything. And I really ought to be able to do both.
I think she did a brilliant job as a working mum. Quite often, in visits to the constituency on a Saturday, I probably saw her open a lot of Christmas fairs and bazaars and that sort of thing. But don't forget, hours in Parliament, she didn't turn up a lot in the evening because votes are often at 10 o'clock and so on. I think I look back and admire the way she juggled it. You're quite right, in those days, I think I was probably one of a handful of children with a working mum in my class at the time.
Have you been able to combine your political life with looking after a family, running a home?
Well, I mainly do the catering here. I like cooking and I do the shopping and always a big batch of cooking at the weekend. And, of course, there are the parliamentary recesses, which coincide with the school holidays, so I can see quite a good bit of the children and take them out. And at half-term, they come up to the House of Commons and have lunch with me.
And did you enjoy the usual family things? Birthdays, holidays, Sunday lunch, Christmases, driving lessons, the things that your friends were doing? Or did you feel like you missed out on some of those normal family life?
I don't feel I missed out, but for instance, Saturday, which was probably a traditional family day, was not in the Thatcher household, because my mother was often in her constituency, because that's what you do as an MP, and my father was a rugby football referee, so he was off blowing his whistle foul. So Saturday, when everybody else was doing family outings, was not the same in the Thatcher household. But there were lots of other things we got to do. I remember my excitement at going to the opening of Parliament or a few things like that. So I've always said it's swings and roundabouts.
So then let's jump ahead then to 1979. By this point, your mum is the leader of the opposition. Clearly an amazing sort of political time with the Callaghan government on a knife edge for months and months and months. When did you start thinking, blimey, she might actually become Prime Minister?
Well, obviously, if you get to be leader of the opposition, there's a chance. Well, no, if you win the next election, yeah. Then you're going to be Prime Minister, aren't you? And actually, after she won, I moved to Australia, which I was going to do anyway. And it's sort of mission creep. If you've got, as I said, a parent as leader of the opposition, and then they become Prime Minister. And I think you develop quite good shock absorbers, because there's always a crisis.
Yeah. It's interesting that. Did you move to Australia because you just wanted to get as far away from people telling you what she should and shouldn't be doing and all of that?
No, I didn't. I'd intended to move to Australia and loved it to bits. I mean, it's a wonderful place to live. But when I came back, don't forget she did 11 years, yeah. Which is the longest serving Prime Minister of the last century. I think I realised that some doors open, some doors close, and some shut, if you can see what I mean, if you've got a parent in number 10. And plenty of people want something from you, or they hate you. So it looks easy, like you're walking on eggshells, take the invitation, smile at the flash bulbs on the red carpet if you're invited to some film premiere or something. But it is a bit of a balancing act. First of all, don't do anything to embarrass the famous parent.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you'll turn up splashed all over the tabloids. For teenagers and, you know, young adults, it's, you know, not overdoing the cocktails in the disco and certainly not driving your car into a lamppost and that sort of thing. I mean, in this century, certainly, Prime Minister's got a lot younger. I mean, Think of it, Blair, Brown, Cameron, Mr. Sunak today, they're younger, so they've got younger children. And a young child is fine, you just smile and look cute. But when you get to be an adult, it gets a bit more complicated.
It's a bit like being a minor royal. You don't have any role, but you've got to do something, you've got to live your life.
Yes.
But with this sort of expectation that if you step outside the parameters, you'll end up on the front pages.
Well, Matt, you've absolutely, that is the key point. I think you need to realise not everyone is talking to you for your pretty face, your challenging intellect or your sparkling sense of humour. They're talking to you because your mum or dad happened to live in 10 Downing Street. So I think you have to stay grounded. Of course, they're privileges. Yeah. I went to dinners at the White House a couple of times.
I hope you won't mind, Mr. President, my recalling that George Washington was a British subject until well after his 40th birthday.
Chequers is a very smart weekender. Yeah. So I can't say that there weren't privileges. You just, I think, you need to have your alarm bells primed as to when you're about to fall in a big black hole.
Take me to a moment where there was a real sort of pinch yourself moment, when you suddenly... Maybe it was in the White House, or even it's just going into number 10 because so few people get to do that. But when did you think, blimey, this is a bit odd?
I think yo-yoing in and out of number 10, because my parents lived there, so I wasn't going in to see the Prime Minister, I was going in to see my parents. But, you know, and walking up that main staircase, which has got all the portraits of previous Prime Ministers back to Walpole in 1735, that never lost for me a little bit of pinching time. My God, I'm here.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
And we had three general elections, which were a bit nerve-wracking. I think I remember there were a lot of crises in the Thatcher years. You know, the Falklands War and the miners' strike and so on. But I think you had to be quite adaptable. And as I said, I do remember my mother saying on one day, I might not be here at 6 o'clock. If this doesn't happen, I might have to resign. And in the flat on top of number 10, which is the Prime Minister's flat, the rest of it is office and entertaining rooms and so on, I thought, oh. And I got some of those gold stars from the local stationers, you know, the ones you get when you're good, when you're 5 years old. And I went round and I put them on everything that was ours. So if we had to move out, then I could say, see this gold star, bung everything in the removal lorry that's got one on. The other thing about politics, you mentioned royals. Well, the royals are in it forever. Politics, you're not in it forever, you see. And the day your mum or dad resigns, you'll find out who your friends actually are, because some of them may never speak to you again.
Did you share your mum's politics? Because, I mean, lots of people have different politics to their parents.
I'm not an especially political person. People said... often ask me, well, do you want to go into politics? No, thank you, one is enough. And did we talk about politics? Quite frankly, if my mother, when she was Prime Minister, wanted to talk about politics, she could find something with more to keep their ears apart than her daughter. And, I mean, obviously there were a lot of political lunches on Sunday lunch at Chequers was, as you might imagine, stocked full of politicians. So if you were sitting next to a cabinet minister, you'd get chapter and verse on his portfolio and that sort of thing. My mother was very strict about that because I was a journalist at the time. If you say anything that you hear in this house, you don't blab to your journalist colleagues, you won't be coming again. And when I look back on that 11 and a half years, I think how extraordinarily lucky I was. It really was a golden thread in the rich tapestry of life.
Mama said there'll be days like this, there'll be days like this, my mama said.
It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio speaking to Carol Thatcher about what it's like if your mum is running the country.
I think after 10 years, you see, the speculation was, 10 years is quite an anniversary in any walk of life. 10 years in number 10 is sort of a landmark anniversary. When's she going to go, this sort of thing? And then, as you say, it sort of piled up. I learned the night before that she was going to resign, someone told me. And I thought, well, that's it. You know, it has to come to an end sometime.
We're leaving Downing Street for the last time after 11 and a half wonderful years. And we're very happy that we leave the United Kingdom in a very, very much better state than when we came here 11 and a half years ago.
I think I was very saddened by probably the nature and the treachery involved of the people in her
because
own party and so
she,
on.
There was this leadership challenge brought about by Michael Heseltine. She didn't win, she didn't lose the first vote, but she didn't win it by enough.
Yeah.
And then she made this, lots of people said it was a mistake, she asked the cabinet individually whether or not they supported her. And they all sort of said, well, of course I would, but it's the others that won't. And it became sort of clear.
I think, look, it was a long time ago, and 11 and a half years is a very long inning. She was longest serving prime minister last century, leader to win three consecutive general elections. And to sort of paraphrase her words, actually, you don't go on and on and on. You know, the shutters do come down on you eventually.
Yes, I hope to go on and on.
Did you speak to her about it in that moment? Was she upset by it, or was she as stoical and accepting of it?
I think she was sort of kind of busy. She had a very big speech to make in the House of Commons the following day. And then there was simply a question, like everyone who's moving house, you've got to get out in a hurry.
And how does she adjust to life outside Danish? I mean, we've obviously got a particular problem at the moment with what you do with former prime ministers, because we've got quite a lot of them.
Well, there have been several in a quick succession. I think it depends how old you are when you're out of office. As I mentioned earlier, we've got prime ministers seem to have got younger. So if you get out at a relatively young age, like you're not at retirement time, then what you do with them is different. I think she was mid-60s. I think it was... Look, it was an almighty shock, and I remember one of her detectives, because she still had protection afterwards, saying that they used to avoid driving down Whitehall, for instance, because if they didn't turn into Downing Street, which they didn't because she was no longer Prime Minister, she'd sort of look up and say, why haven't I gone home? Yeah. So look, it was an almighty shock, it was an almighty adjustment for her.
And did she also find, as you did, that's when you really discover who your friends are, the people who were just, you know, you stop being useful to people.
Oh, sure. And also in those days, I can't say now, there was a switchboard. Okay, and this is pre-mobile phones, to state the obvious. So you didn't die on anything. You picked up the phone and say, I want to speak to Bloggs or the Foreign Secretary or my secretary or whatever. And you were put through. So I remember going to see her after she'd... left, and there were sort of post-its all over the place because you had to write down people's phone numbers because you didn't know them because for years
you didn't have the switchboard
switchboard, you see. So there's some sort of little things, if you like.
There's a sort of a world of Margaret Thatcher which is so detached from being your mother, in fact even detached from being the person, the person who gets quoted in speeches. Margaret Thatcher has thought this, Margaret Thatcher has done that, in the spirit of Thatcherism.
This Conservative Party, the party of the grocer's daughter and the pharmacist's son, will always be the party of enterprise, the party of small business.
Does that bear any relation to the mother that you knew?
Oh, I think there was a private person, and of course there was the politician. Matt, I think, but I'm astonished now, she left in 1990, how often she's mentioned. Yeah. There's a picture of her in the paper about statuism and whatever. So her legacy, I mean, is extraordinarily enduring, whether or not you agree with her politics or not. And, I mean, everyone was pretty scared of her. Oh, a lot of people were pretty scared of her. I remember getting into a black cab in Whitehall, and the taxi driver said, oh, Carol, hello. And he said, pick someone up the other day, I did. been in to see her, he had. Still shaking, he was. So this Iron Lady thing, this reputation almost was really sort of magnified as the years went by.
Were you scared of her? Did she give you the Iron Lady handbagging treatment?
No, I don't recall getting handbagged, no.
And what about the Iron Lady, the film, the Meryl Streep film and The Crown and so on, which you've been depicted in as well as her?
You disregard me. You overlook me. And you favour Mark.
Because he's stronger. Like my father was stronger.
How do you feel about those depictions?
Matt, I tend not to see them. In fact, I haven't seen them. And if someone asks me, what did you think of it? I just say, I haven't seen it yet, which doesn't imply that I don't want to see it because I don't want to see it. I have my own memories. Mm. I was my father's biographer, and that's good enough for me.
How did he cope with being, you were the child of the Prime Minister, he was the husband of the Prime Minister, the first ever husband of a Prime Minister. How did he cope with that? Playing second fiddle, actually, in a world where, you know, the man normally played the first fiddle.
I think Dennis Thatcher was a quite remarkable individual. He came from a generation where love and loyalty were everything, and he was never Mr. Maggie Thatcher. He always remained himself, even though he was the consort to Britain's first woman Prime Minister. He was very discreet. I remember him saying, whales don't get killed until they spout. That was one of his, one of the mantras he lived by. And I think he did a truly remarkable job. I remember someone asking me, American journalist, when Hillary Clinton was running for office, well, what happens if Bill becomes the first dude in the White House, or whatever the term he was going to take on? And I said, look, so the golf's all right, but some of his other pastimes he might have to give up if he's not going to embarrass the wife.
And I suppose that's the key thing, is not
don't embarrass the wife.
Would you prefer it not having had a mother who ran the country?
I think if you have a choice, which most people don't, I think you want to be the parent of a famous child rather than the child of a famous parent. Because imagine, if your mum and dad are someone who wins Wimbledon or clinches an Oscar, you just reflect in the, you know, in the glory, don't you? But if you're the child, then I think there are more hurdles that can possibly get between you and that finishing line. Who does it well, it's also a bit of a no-win situation, to be quite honest. You know, if you do something good, it's easy for her. Mum's in number 10, isn't it? If you do something wrong, oh dear, I mean, honestly, should know how to behave better than that, really. So it can be a no-win situation. If you've got eggshell-sensitive feelings, then go to your doctor and get a prescription.
And obviously, you know, if we go back, 50 years now, she was leader of the opposition and then went on to be Prime Minister. We've had two female Prime Ministers since. Do you think she saw herself as a trailblazer?
She was a trailblazer, but by example, Matt, none of this protesting, you know, joining feminist marches, burning your bras or something. That wasn't her style. Her message was, I've got here, so can you.
And when you look at, you know, so much has been, you know this, so much has been written and talked about, you know, she lowered her voice and changed her clothes. Did you think she had to behave like a man in a man's world in order to get there?
No, I think she behaved like a woman in a man's world, and that probably was one of her many strengths.
Everyone obviously knows the famous Black Door from the outside. What's it like being on the inside? I think even your memoir of it talked about being like a goldfish bowl. What's it like on the inside of the goldfish bowl?
Oh, I think life behind the scenes is always fascinating, isn't it, really? And I do remember one time when I was a journalist in Fleet Street, as it then was, my handbag was stolen in a wine bar. And one of the tabloids said, keys to number 10 might have been stolen. Well, this was ridiculous, because actually there aren't any keys to the famous black, shiny front door, because there's always someone inside to open it.
Yeah.
So you had to be prepared to put up with, good heavens, don't be so ridiculous sort of things.
And when you talked about being in, you know, you were under strict instructions, anything that happens here, whether it's at Chequers or in Downing Street, is off the record, you can't report it. Now, with the benefit of the passage of time, was there a moment when you thought, oh, this is a good story, and kicked yourself that you couldn't do anything with it?
Oh, I'm sure there were plenty of moments. I mean, during 11 and a half years, don't forget, it wasn't a quiet premiership. I'm sure there were many, but look, Matt, it is back in the mists of last century, man.
Well, yeah. Carol, it's been absolutely fascinating to find out what it's like if your mum is running the country. Carol Thatcher, thanks for joining us on Times Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Mama said there'll be days like this, there'll be days like this, my mama said.
That's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget you can catch me Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, bringing you politics without the boring bits on Times Radio. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.